Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits Concept podcast. I am Chuck Anderson, and for the first time all year, our friend Andrew Dewhurst is not available to this week. Well, I hope everything is going good with him because I know he's got some stuff going on the home front. But we do have the venerable, you're venerable now, Justin. How do you feel about being venerable? We have Justin Mason with us. How are you doing today, Justin?
I don't know if I'm venerable or vulnerable, so we'll see how it goes after this podcast.
Yeah, those are mysteriously close phonetically, are they not? So anyway, I can be reached at Twitter, on Twitter, at Just Chucking It. We'll get a Justin Mason bio here as we go through. I was especially interested in getting Justin's opinion on the concept for the day, because he appears to be someone who's a little more straight line about this stuff and doesn't read much into the topic of the day. And the topic of the day is team narratives and how they affect both player performance and how we should value players through the rest of the year. And I compiled a player list today, and I'm going to come up with a narrative and see exactly how much Justin agrees with the narrative for the individual teams that these players play for. What do you think about the idea that now you have to sort of look at where the teams are in the standings and what you actually think is going to happen? You know, obviously it affects what happens at the trade deadline to an extent with some of these teams, but maybe it also affects the fact that if a team is bound to start surging, that certain players are going to catch a windfall of results thereof. What do you think of that, Justin?
Well, before I get into that, let me just throw out a narrative real quick, because I want to promote something and I don't want to forget.
Okay, so, go right ahead, brother.
Since I have it on my mind, please go and help us out, nominate us for the Podcast Awards. Go to podcastawards.com, vote for us in the sports section. And we've kind of teamed up with a couple other podcasts out there, our good friends and friends of the show, Chris McBrien and Yancey Eaton, do a pop culture podcast called Pop Goes Your World, which I highly recommend. I've been on it at least once. My wife's been on it once. And they are trying to get nominated in the entertainment section, which is, I believe, the Rob's Got a Podcast category. And then Sleeper in the Bus, my other podcast that I do with Paul Spohr. Go nominate that in the People's Choice section. So podcastawards.com. All you have to do is kind of sign up for like a login type thing. Vote for us in those respective categories. And that really helps us out, because it would help grow the podcast quite a bit if we were to get nominated, and much less win. So podcastawards.com. Hopefully that is a good start to the narrative podcast. So to answer your question, I don't buy into a lot of narratives, as you kind of alluded to. Here's the one exception, and it kind of fits with what you're talking about, but takes it in a little bit of a different direction. I buy in when we have teams that are looking to buy or sell right now. Those narratives affecting players' playing time. You know, certain guys right now before the trade deadline may get a little bit more action than they might normally because they're being shopped. Certain guys may lose out on a ton of playing time, or gain a ton of playing time, or gain a better team around them or a worse team around them based on where they get traded, or if other guys are brought in. So I think in that terms, I kind of buy that team narratives at this time of year can have an effect on fantasy value. I don't buy that, like, you know, the Brewers are hot, so this player is going to be hot, or this player is hot because, you know, this team is hot, or something like that. So, but I do think that the overall direction of a team can have a dramatic impact on a fantasy player's value and their perceived value too, which can be even more important at this time in terms of fantasy, because we're seeing a lot of trades go down in fantasy leagues. I know I've made 4 trades in the last 24 hours, including one a few minutes ago with Darius Austin.
Oh, wow. And your trade in our three-sport league definitely created some controversy that I didn't understand at all.
I get it, and you know it makes a lot. I understand why the person who was upset with it is upset with it. Like, don't get me wrong, I understand where he's coming from, but this is one of the instances in which you have to take away your preconceived notions and understanding of players' value, especially when it comes down to someone's preseason value. For context, we're in a three-sport league. I am not competing for the overall. I'm trying to get involved in winning the baseball portion, which you are handily leading right now, but I'm hoping the trade I just made will help me. My trade partner is not going to compete for baseball, but could easily win the overall portion of it by just getting a few more points, and especially in the saves department. So I traded him Edwin Diaz and Corey Dickerson for Aaron Judge. Greg Holland came over in the trade, but I'm pretty sure I dropped him this morning. So, he's kind of a non-factor. And at least one person was very upset. I think the majority of the league saw what I was doing. I need power desperately. He needs saves desperately. We both are competing for different things because he's competing for the overall. I'm competing for the baseball portion. And I think it was kind of a win-win trade. And it was hard. It was hard negotiated. I actually offered to make similar trades to get me power and get the other two guys who are competing for the overall championship a better shot at winning it. Neither of the other guys were willing to do it, including our old buddy Eli Rosenzweig, who's no longer part of Friends of Fantasy Benefits, but still running that three-sport league. So the guy who was upset, I think he saw that he had an outside chance to finish second or third in the overall and felt like this hurt his chances. And so I think that's why he was more upset. And he also saw that I was, trading getting a first or second rounder for Edwin Diaz, who was, probably an eighth or ninth rounder. But at the end of the day, it's about what makes your team better. And this makes both of our teams better for what our goal is.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, this is an aside that I've largely stayed away from, but I am on top of the soapbox when it comes to the idea that I despise the concept of trade vetoes in general.
I do too.
Just because, it's too easy for people in your league to look and say, well, this really hurts me. How could he get this player for that player? Which, each team runs their team how they want to and how they see fit. And this is not a case where one of the owners is, one of the owners is just new to fantasy baseball and they're taking their lumps, which you do hear about on a regular basis. Like a guy just doesn't really know what's going on and, he's getting name value, but he's getting fleeced or this, that, or whatever. I mean, and this is, I just immediately spotted off with, well, guess what? This is a category trade, and this is what happens at the end of, when you start getting towards the middle to the end of a fantasy season. And I didn't have any problems with it whatsoever. And what you're doing is exactly what the format is supposed to promote. It's supposed to promote, you've got two separate races going on in baseball. You've got the overall and you've got baseball itself. I'm not remotely in the overall. My first pick in the entire draft was David Johnson. Okay. So I'm not in the overall. I got one quarter from my very first pick. Okay. So I'm all in for baseball, and I'm using smoke and mirrors and everything else. I wouldn't be surprised if I finished fifth in that league. I'm doing everything I can not to, obviously, but in just for a laughable sense, my closers now are Joe Jimenez, Willy Peralta and Fernando Rodney. So I love it when those teams play each other because someone actually has to win. So that gives me a shot.
The fans lose, but one of the teams has to win.
One of those three teams actually has to win.
And the Royals are going to play the Twins quite a bit.
So I mean, I got a lot going on. I made some really good pickups in that league this year with Rod Stripling's been really good for me and some different players like that. I mean, I've done some things well. And ironically, I keep telling people now in the three sport, my first baseball pick was Jose Ramirez, which really doesn't look bad now at all.
No, it's great.
Yeah, but you know, there was a lot of baseball players taken before Jose Ramirez when we drafted last July. My first player was Jose Ramirez. My second player was Jacob DeGrom. So obviously a lot has gone right as well. But anyway, the most important thing out there to remember is avoid trade vetoes whenever possible.
Vetoes should be reserved for collusion. I think we see too often in a lot of leagues, people vote against trades because it's the trade doesn't help them. And veto should be reserved to preserve the integrity of your league, not as a way of protecting your own investments or your own interests in a league. So it's about the betterment of the league, and it's making sure the league doesn't. And in that regards, like some people are like, well, sometimes you have to protect owners. And I don't believe that. The only way you get better and learn is by making mistakes sometimes. And I've made some big mistakes early on. And even, God, you know, I've made plenty of bad trades, you know, since becoming a fantasy analyst, much less when I first got into fantasy. So, like, you learn, and who knows what the outcome of something is going to be, you know?
That's one of the biggest things to me is that people have this idea in their head that they know about a trade. And vetoes in a keeper league, right, just don't make any sense to me at all, to be honest with you, because we don't have any idea. I remember years ago in one of my longest tenured leagues, David Ortiz was traded for Nolan Arenado. Okay, and Nolan Arenado, it was like his first year in Colorado. And people in my league – didn't even realize like what was going on. It's usually a very veto happy league. If it wasn't local, if it wasn't with some of my best friends, I wouldn't even be in the league anymore. It's a very veto happy league. And I was amazed that no one noticed because the guy who acquired David Ortiz, right, just ran away with the league then because it was one of those incredible David Ortiz seasons, right? And Nolan Arenado did virtually nothing. Okay. Well, they had insult to injury. Not only was the guy who got Nolan Arenado was a new owner to the league, okay, but he dropped Nolan Arenado. But that wasn't even really the point. The point to me was, like, that's the only time I can ever remember, like, sort of being upset. I mean, I finished second that year. You know, it's the only time I can remember being upset and saying, you got to be kidding me. Like, you're going to veto all these other trades, but David Ortiz, you know, is going to help this guy an unbelievable amount. Nobody even said anything. And you know, for a year I sat and said, well, Nolan Arenado is not going to be anything. He actually had a pretty steep learning curve at the major league level. He's not somebody, you know, he's kind of like Trout. He had that Trout learning curve where, you know, you said, well, why? What's the big deal about this guy? You know what I mean? And so, you know, years down the line, I'm like, oh, well, there's quite a big deal about this guy. He's been like a top five fantasy pick, conceivable. Well, inside the top 10 for like three straight years. So, you know, and David Ortiz is, you know, doing whatever, playing a lot of golf or whatever he does now. So it's just really hard. It's really hard to think that you know how things are going to turn out. For instance, Aaron Judge really struggled in the second half last year. Mm-hmm. Acquiring Aaron Judge does not necessarily – he's still a guy who's volatile. Not like – you know what I mean? And Edwin Diaz has never had a full year of – closing, really. I mean, last year, I guess, was mostly a full year, but there was some doubts and there was some stretches where they were trying to use some other people for saves. So, you know, it's not like it wasn't like a slam dunk. There was no way it was collusion. And if it's not collusion, it's not vetoable. That's always been my take on it. Well, let's get into this player list because, you know, and I guess I would have focused, had I known that I was going to be in this pod with you, I would have focused a little bit more on the NL West and a little less on the NL Central. But one of the narratives that's definitely I hear every single day in the area that I live in, the story is that the Brewers are terrible after the All-Star break every single year. Well, to go along with that, the flip side of that is that the Cubs coasted last year and then hit the gas pedal strong enough to win the division in the NL Central. And we're kind of getting to that same sort of point. I guess the Brewers won't have quite as big a lead this year as they had last year. But if you want to talk about a coasting Cub, I think the coasting Cub would have to start to be that would start to get looked at first would be Anthony Rizzo, who is hitting 240 with 12 home runs and three stolen bases. And of course, the question becomes: is this all 239 BABIP driven? Anthony Rizzo was a guy who was generally considered a draft bargain towards the end of the second round this year because of first base being relatively loaded. Where do you stand on Anthony Rizzo right now, and do you think he's going to lead a Cubs surge here?
I think there is a pretty good chance that he kind of leads a Cubs charge. I think that... you know, I hate blaming everything on Babbitt, but I think it's a large portion of what's going on. I mean, you're looking at a guy who usually runs at about a 283 Babbitt, running at a 239 Babbitt. And so he should probably get a little bit more lucky on balls in play moving forward. If you look at kind of his StatCast metrics, you know, he's got a little bit of dip in his exit velocity, which I guess could be concerning, but he still hits the ball hard a lot of the time, 38.8%. His ex-WOBA is actually up. His ex-slugging is up. So I think there are things that kind of point to the fact that maybe he's just been a little bit unlucky and that this should turn around. He's actually making more contact than he typically does. He's got a 85.3% contact rate, 93% zone contact rate. So he's making good contact in the zone. It's just finding gloves, and I think that it's a matter of time before things turn around for him, and he could be a big reason why the Cubs, take that division if they do.
Well, I will always want to mention this about the Cubs. There really is no weather-driven stadium more than the stadium that they play in.
Yeah, they're at Wrigley and Camden.
Yeah,
and Arlington.
Yeah, it's just like it's like if the wind is blowing in, right? If the wind is blowing in, you have to hit a mammoth blast to hit the ball out of the park. If the wind is blowing out, you just have to get the ball up in the air. Now, those might be slight exaggerations, but like when you watch games there, that's one thing.
There are days like that. There are totally days in which you hear a ball off a bat and you go, oh, there's no way that's getting out. And you're like, wow, that just went 10 rows deep in center field. So, sure.
And so, I mean, there's some of that can be at play here as well. I openly wonder something else that goes on with Anthony Rizzo. Like, no, there probably isn't a player in the bigs that is over the plate. You know, his whole body and everything is basically over the plate. He leans over the plate as much as any hitter in all of baseball. And that's why he led the league in getting hit for years on end. Because, you know, pitchers really had no choice. I mean, you basically, if you were going to throw strikes, you were going to throw at him almost. So I'm curious to see how that ages. You know, you don't see a lot of players like that. It's funny because there's players who are the opposite. Like Ryan Braun is incredibly off the plate, and he's, you know, seems to be really sliding poorly right now. But I do want to see how that plays itself out over time. But Anthony Rizzo still seems like a pretty good hitter, and I think most of the questions that that us Brewer fans have about the Cubs is if their pitching can rebound without Yu Darvish with Tyler Chatwood. More so than we know that if it comes down to offense, that offense is probably going to be good enough to carry the Cubs.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at his numbers since the beginning of May, because, I mean, his April was just atrocious. But since the beginning of May, his numbers are 270, 361, 469. His BABIP's up to 259, which shows the increase of BABIP goes to the increase of average. Walking back at an 11% mark, striking out at a 10% mark, 11 home runs, 3 stolen bases. This is a stud. He just had a really rough start to the season, and I think he's just going to continue to turn it on as things go on.
Yeah, I mean, and if there's anybody out there that, you know, is kind of out of their league or what have you, and you can acquire Rizzo right now, I certainly would not blame you for taking that kind of a tremendous upside gamble. I mean, you know, obviously his home run pace is off. Mm-hmm. I mean, is off by a pretty decent amount, which is curious because one thing about BABIP, of course, is that home runs don't count. So, I mean, we would have a little more of an explanation if he was on what we would consider a normal home run pace. You know, if he had 20 to, you know, 20 plus home runs, you'd think maybe that was affecting his BABIP some. So home runs really aren't affecting his BABIP. So that means he's getting even more unlucky.
Yeah, but all he needs is like a 10, you know, 10 homer month, which, you know, obviously he can do.
Oh, yeah.
And like, then we're talking like, okay, it's not as big of a deal anymore.
Yeah, and he crushes mistakes, and you got to figure there's plenty of mistakes coming along the line mm-hmm. here yet. Now let's talk about a player who is exactly the opposite. His OPS, his OPS got to 1,000 yesterday. I am one of the few people, and this is actually very humbling for me. I own Jesus Aguilar in an NFBC league that I drafted very early. And I had this master plan in mind that the Brewers were going to acquire a pitcher by trading Jesus Aguilar, and he was going to get all kinds of playing time. That was the only reason that I picked him, and I picked him in the last four rounds of a 50-round draft, which looks really smart right now if the rest of my team wasn't terrible. but the point being is Jesus Aguilar is like – I guess I didn't realize exactly – how much of a three outcome player he really is. He gets a lot of praise on the Brewer broadcast for being a guy who doesn't strike out that much, but he still strikes out 26% of the time. Now he does walk close to 10% of the time, and he's got 23 home runs. You know, it was such a clouded situation at first base and in the middle of a clouded roster, and he was only a pinch hitter last year. But how much of a fall off are you expecting from Jesus Aguilar in the second half? And now it's got to be said. I mean, I watch the Brewers every game I possibly can. And, I mean, he is cemented in the middle of that lineup. Like, they are not sitting him, but to give him a breather every once in a while. So what do you think of Aguilar going forward?
Oof. I mean, I don't think he hits 300.
He doesn't look like a 300 hitter? Come on.
No, but, I mean, he has made, you know, some adjustments in terms of his plate approach. While he is still a pretty aggressive guy, he's making very good contact, especially within the zone, an 85.8% zone contact rate. His contact rate in general is up over 3%. It's hard because, yeah, I mean, he swings and misses so much out of the zone that there's no way the average will maintain and the strikeout rate is going to maintain as is. And so the 26%, 26.6% strikeout rate is likely going to go up. I don't think he can maintain the power numbers at the rate that he's had. I mean, he's got a 28% home run to fly ball rate. That's going to come down. Here's the thing. Dude hits the ball hard. And when he, as long as he's making good contact inside of the zone, he's going to hit home runs. The biggest issue for him has been playing time. I mean, this was a guy who, in a full season's worth of plate appearances last year, would have hit 30 home runs. I mean, he had 16 home runs in just 311 plate appearances. So he's already got 290 plate appearances, and we've seen him with 23 home runs. I don't think the power is fluky. I worry that if he goes into a slump, he could get platooned, especially if once the Brewers are completely healthy. But right now, they're not completely healthy. They don't have another person to play first base full-time. They've sent Domingo Santana down to the minor leagues. So I think Aguilar is going to play quite a bit, and I think he will continue to mash. And like I said, the average is going to come down, but if he hits another 15 home runs, would I be surprised? I don't think I would, and that's kind of crazy because that's 38 home runs on a season for a guy you probably got outside the top 300.
Yeah, and he's projected. The projection systems have him at least 11 more home runs. That's the lowest projection system. Mm-hmm. Has him at 11. That's 34 home runs from a guy outside the top 300. Now, a lot of the surprises in fantasy baseball in recent years have come from the depths of first base. So that, in a way, that's not surprising. It's just that going into the year, the theory was that Thames and Braun were going to split time at first base.
The narrative of today isn't going into the All-Star break, will guys cool off?
Yeah, and that's
I'll tell you about that.
I mean, and you know, there's other narratives that go on right now that we could fully dismiss. I mean, I got to admit, you know, I own Max Muncy in a very important league, and when I found out he was going to hit in the home run derby, I didn't like it. and I have no logical justification for that. You know,
yeah, I think most of the stats have proved out there that is more narrative driven than actually factually driven. I didn't even know Max Muncy was in the home run derby until you just said that, because I really just don't care about the All-Star game. You know, for me, it's like, okay, let my guys get healthy if they're injured, and then they get to come back, and I get a few days off of having to write about baseball.
Have you heard of the I Believe in Jesus movement that's going on?
I actually do love that. That's pretty. It's I Believe in Jesus, but yes, I do. That's the only part of the All-Star game that I truly enjoy is the vote in here that we're doing the extra vote. I can't remember what they call it, but only because the players do funny things, like the videos and stuff on Twitter are fantastic right now.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, if you wanted to create a player narrative, a player that is easy to root for is definitely Jesus Aguiar, because, you know, he's somebody that, you know, I maybe just didn't really look the role of being a great hitter. You know, he's a little pudgy, you know, and a lot of the broadcast time that's given to Aguiar now locally is talking about the fact that he's actually a very good defender. He's subbed in at third base a few times this year. He made a ridiculous play barehanded, took an error away from a pitcher that was basically just throwing the ball past him. He's a lot more nimble than he looks. And it's just the career, you know, he really had to prove himself in the minors. This was not a guy who was, who was labeled a superstar, and we were just waiting for him to come out. This is a guy who really probably had to overperform and overperform just to get a legitimate shot. But I knew of him before he was a Brewer, and the talk of him when he was first in spring training, like, oh, he's mashing and, you know, he's been a really good player. I just thought, well, yeah, blah, 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 blah. I thought he was a quadruple A player. I'll be the first to admit it.
Most people did. Let's be honest. Like there wasn't a ton necessarily in his profile and his pedigree to say that he wasn't much more than a quad A player.
And so, I mean, it's a really neat story, and it'll be interesting. We get to vote until 3 o'clock today. We've set up our kid. My wife is voting for him right now. And I will say this: one thing that should be said about Milwaukee, okay, one thing is that we really support that team. I mean, that team is, they sold out on Sunday. They had, during the week, they regularly get, 25, 30,000 fans for every game during the week. Even when they're relatively out of it, they're going to get over 20,000 for weekday games. And we see regularly Cincinnati stands are completely empty, 6,000 people at a Marlins game, 8,000 people to 13,000 people at Rays games. I mean, the team does get supported, which is kind of neat because Milwaukee, unbeknownst to many people, Milwaukee is the third smallest market in the three major sports. So for them to be in the top five every year in attendance in the National League is pretty amazing. So anyway, let's move on from them and let's talk about what I think is the most bizarre thing that's happened all year. Okay, and I know a lot of it maybe can be blamed on injuries, but the fact that the Washington Nationals are like 16 games behind the Brewers right now, and I know that's taking an extreme because we didn't think the Brewers were going to be this good, but the fact that the Nationals have been hovering, 2 to 4 games above 500 with that roster is downright confounding. And I think we're getting to the point where people are worried that they're not going to catch the Phillies. But if you do think that they're going to catch the Phillies, then maybe a guy that deserves a little helium is a very talented player who hasn't been able to get on the field much, and that's Adam Eaton. So first of all, what do you think about the Nats, and what do you think about buying into Adam Eaton right now?
I think the Nationals will be fine. I think they're gonna get Strasburg back here shortly. Ryan Zimmerman will be back shortly. Sean Doolittle shouldn't be on the DL for very long. And they have Kelvin Herrera lined up as the interim closer in Doolittle's absence. I think they're going to be just fine. I'm not worried about it. It seems like Victor Robles may actually make an appearance at some point later this summer because he's now kind of rehabbing and playing in minor league games. So from a team perspective, I don't believe the Phillies, unless the Phillies go out and make some major moves at the deadline, the Phillies got a lot of holes, especially in that offense. And I honestly, I don't know how much I trust Gabe Kapler as a manager yet. I think they've overperformed. It's a great story, just like the Atlanta one has been a great story. But I think both of those teams, while they could compete for a wild card spot, I think Washington will eventually overtake them. All it takes is some, hot stretch for the Nationals. They'll be fine. They've got Juan Soto, who's been playing amazingly. Bryce Harper is not going to struggle this long. I'm not worried about the Nationals from a team perspective. I'm not particularly worried about Adam Eaton. So I think, I think maybe people were expecting him to show a little bit more power, a little bit more speed early on. Maybe that was a little bit kind of foolhardy considering the devastating injury he was coming off of. But I think, he'll continue to provide really nice average, really nice on-base percentage, some good counting numbers because he's hitting on top of that lineup for the most part. He's doesn't have a sexy profile because he's not going to steal a lot of bases. And he's not going to hit a lot of home runs. So he's Melky Cabrera-esque.
Well, 18 runs scored in 33 games is certainly certainly something that you can look at and say, well, that's probably what should happen at the top of that lineup. Also, he's got 5 multi-hit games in his last 8 games. Mm-hmm. And he's a guy we've seen. I mean, I think the first week of the season before he got hurt, I mean, he went on some ridiculous tear. He had like 13 hits in a weekend. He is that type of player that just can spray the ball to all fields effectively. And of course, if he can do that on a regular basis, I think he could see a pretty good surge. Part of being able sort of outline these podcasts is definitely, you know, me asking some questions that I just wonder about personally. And one of the things I'm wondering about now, and part of this comes from the fact that that a big group of us went to the game on Friday night, and that where Foltynewicz got pounded for 5 runs in an inning, is part of what I'm asking is that a lot of people seem to still, and they should. I mean, the Braves have made a really nice step forward. It's a really good story. But I kind of look at that rotation and I say, well, what is going to buoy that rotation? You know, because, you know, you got guys in Foltynewicz who hasn't had a good full season. You also have, whatever is going on with Newcomb right now. He's not looking very good. And a guy who's kind of having
shocking that a guy who faded down the stretch last year would fade down the stretch this year.
Well, and then so if you want to make a reach and you want to say, well, somebody's going to step forward, sort of their veteran presence is a guy that they picked up at the end of spring training. It was just like a throwaway, and that's Anibal Sanchez. And, you know, he's 34 years old already. He's pitching pretty well right now. He's got his walk rate down on the year. And if you want to buy into the Braves sticking in there, I think they need a big boost from a player like this. Do you have much hope in Anibal Sanchez? Would you be willing to pick him up and sort of see how he does in shallower leagues, stuff like that?
Not particularly. I think he is a streamer in like 15-team leagues. One, I mean, there's no way he's going to continue doing what he's doing right now. I mean, outside of giving not giving up home runs every other second, he's not really doing much that, you know, points to this working out better long term. He is getting a few more ground balls, but that's about it. And I think it's just a matter of time before that that bandbox of a stadium, especially in right field, wreaks havoc on him. So I'm not a big fan of Anibal Sanchez. We're not seeing like a spike in velocity or a real change in pitch mix. You know, the slider is been average, which is better than it's been in a few years, but it's still just average. The cutter has been better this year, and I think that's where some of his success has come from. But I think it's a matter of time before injury or regression just takes him down.
Well, I mean, and within the context of that pitching staff, I do wonder who you like. I mean, before the season started, Luis Gohara was the guy that a lot of people had their hopes on, and they're using him kind of as a late-inning multi-reliever guy, kind of trying to groom him into a Hader-esque role maybe. I'm just trying to figure out who's going to buoy that rotation down this stretch. Do you have a good guess? Do you think it's Foltynewicz?
I mean, I think it needs to be, you know, the guys they have in that rotation right now, Newcomb, Turan, and Foltynewicz. You know, Kobe Allard could be up at some point. He's one of their top pitching prospects. I don't think they're going to... I mean, it'd be interesting to see if they make a big move at the deadline for a starting pitcher, but I think they've got enough in that rotation already to kind of give themselves a chance. I haven't really heard the Braves connected to any major pieces outside of rumors that they could be shopping for Mike Moustakas. So which I think would be a great fit in that stadium. I think they're going to kind of live and die by what they have, and either they need Newcomb or in Foltynewicz to turn it around or bring up one of the young guys. You know, it's kind of a bummer Mike Soroka got hurt and is on the 60-day DL because that means he's not going to be available till at least mid-August, more than likely. I was really actually enjoying watching him pitch seeing what he could do. But I think Gallard comes up at some point, and I think they're just going to kind of ride with what they've got and hope that that's enough to keep them in the race for a wild card spot.
Well, you know, I should pretty much call Julio Teheran my foolish pride boy because, you know, I had a lot of hopes for him going into last season. as maybe being underrated because he had gone back and forth. And he is actually pitching. His results have been better recently.
The surface numbers are better. The underlying numbers are just as bad, if not actually worse than last year.
That hasn't hurt John Lester.
Yeah, I mean, he's gotten a little bit lucky in the BABIP department, which has helped. The home runs he's given up haven't been of like the 2 and 3 run variety. It's been a lot of solo shots, but he's actually given up more home runs per nine this year. He's walking more guys than he has. So,
I still can't buy into him being quite as bad as he was last year. Which is fine. That doesn't make him somebody that's particularly fascinating for fantasy, though.
The stuff has been better this year, but, he's just getting, he's getting a little, he's a guy. I don't know if there is a pitcher in Major League Baseball other than John Gray that needs a trade more than Julio Teheran. I mean, if that stadium was built by someone who loves Freddie Freeman, it was also built by someone who hates Julio Teheran.
Quite true, quite true. And despite the fact, that I've had a soft spot for him, the Milwaukee Stadium wouldn't be any better for him either. Let's move on to, I often mention that we get in heated discussions in our staff chat. Recently, Justin's even had to cool down some of the discussions, which I don't really think were heated like at a personal level. Yeah, wasn't it you bringing the video games in? Wasn't that?
Oh, I was just bored. I wasn't even paying attention to what you guys were talking about.
Okay, well, that's probably a good idea some of the time. I tend to be at the center of a lot of the storms on that chat.
Shocking! Shocking that you would be the one in the middle stirring the shit up.
Anyway, one of the questions that was posted on there a few days ago was if you would prefer Trevor Bauer or Clayton Kershaw long term in Dynasty.
Oh wow, and, I did not see that.
Yeah, and I was the leader of the. I was right in the front of the train saying that I am all about Trevor Bauer over Clayton Kershaw in a Dynasty league. And I'm even all about Trevor Bauer over Clayton Kershaw for the rest of this season, even when Clayton Kershaw is showing signs of pitching well, just because I have more concerns about Clayton Kershaw's back than I do about Trevor Bauer playing with drones.
Okay, so I'm going to just jump in. So your rationale, and I'm not saying it's bad rationale, it's probably actually pretty logical, but your rationale is purely based on health for Kershaw. It's not based on skills. Because I think we can agree a healthy Clayton Kershaw is more valuable than Trevor Bauer, right?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I mean, the original question about Dynasty,
is long-term health.
Yeah, and I think the 3 years of concerns about Clayton Kershaw's back. And he was really, I think people forget now because we're in an age where pitchers don't get wildly overused, that Clayton Kershaw was leaned on really, really, really hard the early years of his career. He was a regularly 225 plus inning kind of guy. Mm-hmm. There's some, when the Dodgers staff wasn't deep, they were leaning pretty hard on Clayton Kershaw. So I think there's a mileage factor as well here. And Trevor Bauer's odd sort of ascension to where he is now has actually kind of limited his innings, has limited his mileage. So there are two completely sort of different pitchers, in my opinion. And, Trevor Bauer, I think one of the reasons I wanted to put him on here is because – I don't know what the narrative is for an Indians team that basically could play. I think they could play like 10 games under 500 the rest of the way and still win their division. They have an 8.5 game lead now, and I don't see any chance of a major surge. I don't believe there's a major surge coming from any of the teams behind them. And so I don't know how this plays into our narrative theory. And I also just want to see if. I'm really buying into Trevor Bauer next year as a top 10 style pitcher. And I wonder if you think that's if you think that's way too strong. I mean, the division is not going to get wildly better, wildly fast. And, you know, and maybe I'm just wildly over, overly thinking that Trevor Bauer has massive stud potential, and we're seeing a lot of good signs of it. Where are you on Trevor Bauer? Because this is something that you know, your buddies Paul Sporer and his Sunday evening chat. This is the kind of player they really like to analyze. What do you think about Trevor Bauer?
I love Trevor Bauer, and I have for a long time. I've been a big Trevor Bauer supporter. That being said, I don't trust Trevor Bauer because I've owned lots of shares of Trevor Bauer for a very long time. And the problem with Trevor Bauer is he is a tinkerer. I don't know if you saw the at-bat that he had, or the matchup in an at-bat he had with Joey Votto, where he shook off the catcher 8 times in one at-bat.
that's actually a fascinating approach to trying to get into Joey Votto's head. Which I don't know if that's possible anymore or not.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think Bauer is going to be in the conversation next year as a top 15 to 20 pitcher. I don't know if I could put him in the top 10 because that's putting him above guys like Blake Snell, Garrett Cole, Aaron Nola, Corey Kluber, Jacob deGrom. I mean, I think you'd have to put, you know, guys like Berrios and McCullers and Paxton, all in that kind of category. I think he's in the conversation, but I'm not willing to trust him yet. I think he's, while he hasn't done this on the backs of any sort of luck, I think that he is a guy who will tinker with things. You know, I've made the comment that he is the BJ Upton of pitching, that BJ Upton would tinker with his swing until he found something that would work, and then he'd continue to tinker with it. And I think that is what kind of pitcher Trevor Bauer is. And so would it surprise me if next season he is a guy that comes out and does the same things and is super successful? No, it wouldn't. But it wouldn't surprise me, too, if he completely goes away from what made him successful this year and is atrocious. So, I can't put him, I don't want him as my number one starting pitcher next year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is a lot to like in his stat line this year. There's no doubts about that. I mean, his FIP is 2.15. Mm-hmm. You know, the 11.69 Ks per nine is, you know, especially saucy in fantasy terms. You know, and he's slightly down on his walks. I mean, way down from a few years ago. He does have that reputation of being somebody who tinkers with stuff. And the question is going to be, are we seeing a maturity that's come out of him? Because not only do we have the history with the drone, but we also have the problems that he had, you know, coming up with sort of taking coaching and different things like that. He's 27 now, and so there will be sort of two separate. You're going to have to buy into one camp or the other to get him, because I do think he's somebody who's going to have pretty good helium in drafts next year.
I think he is going to be, I mean, unless something could, you know, falls apart here in the next few months or he gets injured, I think he's probably going to be going as a starting pitcher one in, at least on that border in 15 team leagues. So.
Yeah, I mean, you're gonna have to decide if you buy in. I mean, I guess I would call it like sort of where Robbie Ray got drafted this year, mm-hmm. which I don't want to make that comparison because I don't think he's quite that volatile.
No,
I mean, yeah, I mean, so it's hard to say. I mean, he's coming off a 12 strikeout, you know, zero earned run in 8 inning performance, you know, and he literally has one start in his last 10 where he hasn't struck out over 10 batters per nine. So he's to say that he's surging right now is an understatement. I mean, you can, as you would expect, you can look. He's played Minnesota, the White Sox twice, Detroit twice, at Kansas City, you know, and the bullpen blew the big game for him yesterday. But the point being is if you buy into wanting pitchers that have some extra insulation by the division that they pitch in, he's going to be a guy that I think will be
for sure.
be very, very sought after next year. Quickly, let's talk about I want to talk about the Dodgers for just a second because you're an NL West guy. What do you think about the what do you think about the Dodgers in general right now? And do you feel like I know you're right in the middle of it there and watching the Giants. Do you think that that the Dodgers are the best team in the West? And do you think that they're going to catch the catch Arizona?
I don't know. I think they have the most talent of any team in the West. The question is, can that talent stay on the field? Because that's been a real issue and continues to be a real issue. There isn't, I mean, other than Ross Stripling, there isn't a single member of the rotation that doesn't have some sort of injury issue, or injury risk at least. They just lost Yasiel Puig to the DL. I think there is a lot of questions about this offense and the offensive potential. As currently constructed, no, I think Arizona is the best team in that division. And the question becomes will the Dodgers make the trades necessary to rectify some of these issues? And I think they will. I think they tasted a World Series, and they came within one game of winning it, and they're not going to let this window shut without giving it everything they've got, and they've got a ton of minor league depth to trade from. I think they land Manny Machado, Zach Britton, and maybe other pieces, and this is a team that is the best team in the NL West by August 1st.
Well, and just because I do think the rest of the country, here in the central and the eastern time zone sometimes misses some things that are going on within teams on the West Coast, I just want to mention that Kenta Maeda is really, really having a nice season. And, he's just off the paternity list right now. But he's got a 2.89 FIP. And his nearly 11 Ks per nine is the best of his career. If you believe that the Dodgers surge is coming, and I do think Arizona has staying power, especially getting Pollock back. I saw he homered last night. I mean, they've got staying power, so it's going to be an intriguing race down the stretch. I think Kenta Maeda is a guy that people in your league might not realize exactly how nice of a season that he's having. He's actually having his best season.
I mean, the problem has been with Maeda is how deep into games is he going to go? Because he's got almost as many games under six innings pitched than he's had six or more. So it's a real question of what are we getting down the stretch, and do the Dodgers limit his innings? One, because they can profit from him based on his profit from it based on the contract, because they're afraid that he might break. So I like Maeda, and I think he is very, like you said, no one's talking about how well he's pitching, but I don't know how much I trust him down the stretch. I don't know how much I trust really anybody in this rotation, shockingly, other than Ross Stripling down the stretch. I don't know. We'll see what happens with them. I think they're going to be in it, I can't remember the last time I saw a division like this with four teams above 500 this, going into the All-Star break. It's no matter how it finishes, obviously two of these teams most likely are not going to be in the playoffs. I'm assuming at least two of them will be, though who knows? I mean, that's the thing with the National League is, it's super top heavy and super bottom heavy. Like, there aren't these like mid level teams for the most part. It's really good teams and really bad teams. So, I mean, theoretically, we could see two playoff teams from any of the divisions.
Yeah, and you know, it was said last night. I was talking to some of my sports buddies, and it was said last night. You know, I said if the Brewers go 500 the rest of the year, they win 90 games, right? And then somebody said, and I don't think that'll make the playoffs. Yeah, it may not. And you know, getting to your point that you're making right now is a pretty good team is not going to make the playoffs.
I think there's going to be a number of good teams that don't make the playoffs. You know, that's you know, right now we're looking at if the season ended today, we would have the Dodgers, who are 49-42, not in the playoffs.
Yeah, and that's kind of shocking. And you know, you'd have obviously you'd have the Cubs in a play-in game right now, which is, you know, certainly in doubt that that would remain the same the rest of the year. But I mean, I'm assuming then that the Nationals are not even close right now.
No, right. I mean, currently the Nationals are seventh in the wild card race.
So, I mean, there's, you know, a lot's going to change. We're basically a little past the halfway point. I get that. But at the same time, there's going to be some dramatic reaction to what's going on. I mean, the Nationals, this is the closing of a window in their own way. So you're going to see them really go for it here. The Brewers have always been have pulled off some dramatic moves at the trade deadlines over time. And I think you'll see them use some of their minor league depth here in an interesting fashion. And the Dodgers, you know, everything from Alex Verdugo to that May kid that's in, I think May is only in double A, if that, as a pitcher. So they've got a tremendous amount of depth, four or five different pieces that they could work off of. And the Brewers have a lot of major league depth and some minor league depth. So we're going to see some reactions to exactly what we're saying, that the National League could go a number of different ways, and there's a bunch of teams that could go everywhere from winning their division to not being in the playoffs at all. It's going to be fascinating to see. But I wanted to touch on some players that I thought were kind of interesting right now that we're not getting a lot of publicity within these sort of team narratives of what we sort of expect to happen from here on out, which is not something we do very often. So anyway, Justin, thank you so much for your time today. Why don't you give everyone a Twitter handle and for the three or four people that we may have out there that aren't following you. I'm assuming almost everyone does, but go ahead anyway.
You can reach me on Twitter at Justin Mason, FWFB. You can email me or the show, friendsoffantasybenefits@gmail.com. Feel free to nominate us for the Podcast Awards, podcastawards.com. Also nominate our friends Pop Goes Your World in the entertainment section and Sleeper in the Bust in the People's Choice. Nominate us, obviously, in the sports section. You can follow my work at Fangraphs, Fantasy Alarms, Fantracks, Fantasy Sports Radio, and I think that is it.
How many T-shirts did they give you a count of how many T-shirts were sold with your caricature on the front?
I have no idea. I know I bought at least I bought three. So I have a nice Father's Day picture with me, my wife, and my daughter. It's actually on my Twitter. It's my Twitter like background photo, so you can go check that out with all three of us wearing it, and my wife not being too pleased about it.
Well, no, you put in a ton of hard work, and it's been really fun to be around your ascension within the fantasy community, and it's obviously been great. We just sort of live off the spoils in our own way.
It's funny because I I joke around all the time that I'm pretty much riding all of your guys' coattails.
So. Yeah. I think that's very much not true. We just try to be diligent enough to help you in what you're doing, and you know what Darius and a number of the other very talented staff members, you know, Paul Martin and Walter McMichael are incredible additions to the staff as well. So hopefully their roles increase therein, and for us as well. I'm Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at Just Chucking It. I've basically been overseeing the the Monday and the Wednesday podcast this year, which has been a lot of fun for me to work with talented people like Andrew and Darius and Justin on occasion here. So anyway, we'll try and come up with another good concept for you next week. There will not be a pod quiz podcast this week. I apologize about that. Various things happened to make that not be a possibility. But I really appreciate your all the continued support out there. And like Justin says, the podcast awards, I think we deserve a nomination for all the hard work and diligence we've put through for giving you guys great off-season and in-season content. So this has been an FWFB podcast with the concept variety. So thanks so much for your time, and we will be back at you very soon.